and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and today we're doing our CISSP, and specifically we're going to continue our conversation on IP networking and protocols. We're going to start moving into the world of wireless protocols, and that changes security up a little bit, might change what security methods we're using, what protocols we're using. So here to help us with all of that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How you doing, Adam?
I'm good. I am untethered. I am wireless.
Woo-hoo.
Awesome. I still, however, have really cool socks, nonetheless.
Okay.
All right, so let's talk a bit about wireless, right? So we're going to continue our conversations with regards to IP networks, protocols, how we deal with security-related issues, all those kind of things. Very important. We don't want to leave wireless out because, as we know, ultimately, a lot of network traffic goes across wireless networks, right? And for instance, right now, sitting here talking to you, I'm using a wireless network in order to stay connected and do various things. You know, it's very common today in the enterprise that we use wireless communications. If you think about the fact that your cell phone, your smart device, right, that we use, because remember, I love apps, so we have lots of apps on phones. Smart devices are typically connected wirelessly. Tablets, a lot of the times, are connected wirelessly. We're using more and more of these devices in the enterprise today. Becoming more prevalent, in fact, for us to use wireless networks than it may be for us to be wired or tethered to a traditional network for the majority of the work we do every day. So this is not uncommon. And for a CISSP, we have to be able to understand the generic concepts associated with wireless. We have to be able to understand the topology, the design of the network when it comes to wireless. We have to understand how wireless networks actually back into wired networks, because there really is no such thing as truly wireless networking. We tether and connect a wireless access point somewhere back to our network stack. So there is a wire component of that. We want to understand that, because that communication channel has to be managed as well. We want to understand that wherever we put the word wireless in front of something, while it may change certain things, the reality is the laws of networking don't change, right? Packets are packets, IP addresses are IP addresses, as we've discussed with you. And the concept of wireless networking is simply an extension of networking. And so we want to think of it from that perspective, at least to begin our conversation, kind of as a baseline, if you will. So wireless networking, what we would think of as wireless LANs, what's commonly referred to today as Wi-Fi, is really the traditional thought process that we use when we talk about and frame and think about the conversation with regards to wireless networks. We have a standard that we often refer to for wireless networks. IEEE 802.11 is going to be the wireless specification overall. And we're going to then talk about categories within 802.11. There's 802.11a, b, g, I, etc. But generically, the 802.11 specification overall deals with wireless. So we're going to focus on that. One of the first things you want to know as a CISSP is that when we throw out an IEEE standard designation, 802.11 for wireless, 802.3 for Ethernet, 802.5 for, Mr. Mike?
I do not know. Is that the token ring?
There we go. Token ring, right?
I knew my Network Plus would come back to me eventually.
Just got to occasionally prod him with a stick to get him to remember these things, right? So just like Mike, right? And in this case, you actually want to be like Mike. Let me explain why. You may not remember 802.5, and that's okay. Most people don't. But you have to remember it when you are taking the exam. So just like Mike went through the process thinking, what is that? I'm not sure. Is it a token ring? Right? You've got to keep in mind that these standards, at least the three or four we throw out at you, are going to be important. So you want to make sure you know what they are. 802.3 is probably the most widely used and talked about standard because it's Ethernet. It's been the most widely deployed and used forever in a day. But 802.11 for wireless is obviously very important. Token ring has gone the way of the dinosaur. Nobody hears about that or talks about that anymore. But the reality is you still need to know about it as a historical footnote. So just make sure you're familiar with those. Equate the numerical designation with the name, and you're fine. We're not going to ask you anything more about it than that, but you may very well need to know with regards to a scenario, with regards to a sentence or two in a question, that if we say the 802.3 standard and we don't spell out Ethernet, you still understand what we're talking about, in other words, right? If we said 802.11, we didn't spell out wireless, you would pick up on that and answer the questions appropriately. That would also be important. So just make sure you're aware of that. The idea behind this thought process is ultimately to help us to figure out how to communicate wirelessly. That's what the 802.11 standards are all about. In a modern network, we often talk about deploying what's known as a mesh. A mesh is an overlapping technology architecture or topology type that allows us to interconnect every device to every other through redundant and multiple connections, right? So if Mike and I we're both being networked together, and we wanted to create a single connection, right? We would effectively just string one line between the two of us, and that would effectively just be a single connection. If we wanted to have a mesh, a redundancy built into that, we'd have to have two lines of communication between us, and by doing that, we would have a secondary connection. If we added a third person or third point into the connection model, so if we had Mike, myself, and perhaps Bob or Alice sitting over there in the corner, we'd have to then spool connections out to them and make sure those connections went from myself to Bob, Bob to Mike, Mike to me, and then we'd have to have Bob to me and Bob to Alice, and you know, you get the idea. Everybody connects to everybody. And so the idea with a wireless mesh is simply the same thing, but we're simply doing this on a wireless network as opposed to in a wired network. Radio nodes are going to be organized in mesh topologies when we deal with wireless networks, meaning wireless access points and the transmission mechanisms we use to be able to send and receive are going to be set up this way. Each node forwards information on behalf of all the other nodes if needed, and it can self-heal, meaning if one node is to fall out for some reason, we turn one off, something gets unplugged, something fails, whatever it is, all the others, because of the overlapping connections, are still able to reach all the other areas and communicate. And so a single node failure in a mesh is not really going to be a problem. We simply just close ranks, if you will, and route traffic back through the other areas of the mesh, and effectively the mesh holds. And as a result of that, everything is still going to be able to connect, and we consider everything to still be redundant and therefore online. We always want to talk about Bluetooth, one of my most favorite technologies, as you've heard me rant and rave about before, with regards to wireless. A wireless PAN, a personal area network, is what we often think of as Bluetooth or think about with regards to Bluetooth. We interconnect devices, as I explained in one of our prior episodes, within a small, relatively controlled geographic area, 2 to 3, maybe 3 to 4 feet at the most. May be able to go out to up to about 30 feet, depending on the configuration and the power rating on the Bluetooth device, but certainly very, very narrowly defined. Within 5 to 10 feet of you certainly is about the extent of what most Bluetooth networks will be good for. This is going to be the 802.15 standard. So 802.11 is wireless. 802.15 is going to be the Bluetooth or wireless PAN standard. WiMAX, which is Wi-Fi, wireless across a very large distance, very high speed, is going to hit potentially up to rates about 30 megabits per second right now, even higher depending on where they're deploying this this technology, kind of how it's set up. Data rates of over 30 megabits per second potentially on a wireless network are pretty robust and pretty high. The idea is that we use WiMAX networks to be able to wire up large geographic areas, like the downtown corridor of a city, for instance, right? Or a residential neighborhood may be wired up with WiMAX. So where my parents live, there is a WiMAX network that's actually been set up. And so the whole area in the residential communities where they are wired up, or wireless rather, but connected. So effectively you can go, drive through there, you know, sit in a park, do whatever, and the reality is you have wireless anywhere you go within the residential corridor. So it's becoming more common in cities today to see this kind of stuff. We also have a wireless MAN, a wireless metropolitan area network. This is going to connect several different wireless LANs together into a larger geographic area as well. 802.16 is the standard for wireless MAN. 802.15 would be Bluetooth. Wireless PAN, 802.11 is Wi-Fi overall, right? So just be aware of that and just be thinking about the different standards associated with it. We also have wireless WANs, wireless wide area networks. We can, in other words, link large geographies together wirelessly and create a WAN. Branch offices may be connected this way, things of that nature. If we have a campus scenario where we have multiple different offices in different parts of a city, may connect them up and using wireless WAN technology to be able to do that. So if you go to like a college campus, for instance, right, you may have all the buildings wirelessly interconnected through a common wireless system. That would constitute a wireless WAN if it's large and geographically spread out. We don't want to leave out cellular networks, right? Cellular networks are going to be the standard we often think of when we think about wireless today, but they actually are radio networks. They are wireless, but they are wireless radio transmission networks, and they're going to be able to effectively transmit over usually about a 1 to 2, maybe 2.5 or so to 3 mile radius at the most. We have cell towers, in other words, that will exist, or radio towers that repeat the signal every 2 to maybe 2.5 to 3 miles, give or take. And the idea is that we propagate that signal as you move between cell sites or cell towers. We propagate that signal and it follows you, which is why your handheld device effectively stays connected. you're really just using a very expensive Apple-branded walkie-talkie, because that's really more or less what you have with a cellular network. And, of course, my most favorite thing, we have apps on them. So that's also very important as well. But the idea is that basically, you know, we're going to have just a very, very large, obviously technically complex, much more complex today than a standard old-fashioned radio, you know, solution or a handheld set of walkie-talkies that we used to have years ago. But this is still basically a land carrier-based radio network that's transmitting cell tower to tower, or radio tower to tower, to be able to propagate your signal. It's just that we have thousands of towers set up everywhere, which is why we have coverage across very, very large distances with cellular networks. But with all these kinds of networks, we have security issues like we do with everything else. We have the worries about authentication. How do we authenticate to get onto this system? Is it an open authentication solution? Is it a proprietary solution? Certain vendors use their own APIs. We have to be aware of that. Are we going to run the wireless network in what's called ad hoc mode, effectively just allowing individual workstations, perhaps my computer and Mike's computer sitting here on the podium, we could connect together in what's called ad hoc mode and never need a wireless access point effectively to associate. We can do that. If we allow that to occur device to device within a couple of feet of each other, we can do that. But the problem is, we don't authenticate for ad hoc, at least traditionally we don't. Mike's device, because he's running an Apple device, will probably challenge my non-Apple device to a duel, because Apple always thinks it's better than everybody else. So when I try to connect to him in ad hoc mode, it will probably challenge me and say, hey, who are you? But we could get around that pretty easily, and he and I could communicate and connect with minimal difficulty, minimal authentication required. So ad hoc mode may be good, but the problem is it also can lead to complications. What if somebody gets within a couple of feet of your system, connects up to you through ad hoc mode without you necessarily knowing, and as a result of that, they're able to then get access to information that you've shared? They may be able to take information off your system without your knowledge and, importantly, without your consent. So we have to think about that. We want to try to run an infrastructure mode. Infrastructure mode is what we refer to where we actually use wireless access points. We use authentication mechanisms. We use the traditional knowledge we have for wireless networking, the enterprise, to set things up and use that knowledge to secure the systems the right way, in other words. We know, and I have talked about, and we will obviously continue at some points in our conversation to mention WEP. We know that WEP is something we should not be using anymore. The Wired Equivalent Privacy Protocol has been deemed dead for several years now. It is still, interestingly enough, a choice you can make in many devices, even though we don't recommend you use it. So figure that out, right? We've talked about common sense, the fact that when something's bad, you really just shouldn't do it. But clearly, the reason that that's still so showing up and is still there is that we have so much older infrastructure out there that has never just been updated or has never been replaced, at least up until now. So WEP was still a viable option at the point where those devices were deployed initially. And even though they may have been updated with firmware updates and things like that, WEP may not have been removed as the underlying one of the underlying protocols. So we do want to know that. But in new devices, you'll typically not see WEP as an option. What you do see is certainly things like TKIP, which is initially what replaced WEP, although it also has had problems that we don't tend to use that much anymore. You'll see WPA, followed by WPA2 Enterprise, because that's the most secure, currently the most secure version of wireless authentication and security protocols we can deploy. So you will see things like that, and so WPA2 Enterprise would be the preferred option, would be what you would want to use for authentication and encryption solutions. I mentioned TKIP. You may see TKIP there as well, although TKIP, as I said, has also had problems and is suspect as a use, or rather suspect for use as a result of that. We may be able to fall prey to things called parking lot attacks, which sound a little bit sinister, but the reality is it's a very simple thought process. When you set up your wireless networks, if we're not doing a site survey and we're not checking on where our signals are, how far out they propagate beyond the border of our office. So in other words, you know, you typically set up a wireless network inside of an office. We have glass, we have walls, we have permeable substances that sit there. If we put a wireless access point right up against the outer wall of a building and we angle the antennas facing out, the wireless signal is going to shoot out into the parking lot or whatever's beyond the building for up to several hundred yards, depending on how powerful that system is. If we've done that without really thinking about that, we've effectively now given everybody in the parking lot access to the wireless network, even though we may not want them to have that. You know, I often talk about this, and I explain this to customers and to students by talking about the fact that when you often drive up to Starbucks or McDonald's or, you know, wherever you get wireless access today that's free, and it's in a lot of these places, almost every restaurant, every bar, every coffee shop has it. But when you drive up to Starbucks, especially depending on where you live, you often see three or four people sitting in cars outside, right, on computers, operators doing work, and they're just sitting there in the parking lot because the wireless signal bleeds out of Starbucks, depending on the structure of the building, and is strong enough that they could just sit there. So they'll go through the drive-thru, get their coffee, they'll park, and these are usually salespeople, and you'll see them on the phone doing the computer thing. Thankfully, they're not trying to drive while they're doing that, so that is an improvement, definitely. But, you know, they're sitting there effectively using the open wireless signal. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But if that was a company and that signal was supposed to be protected and now you're sitting out there and effectively squatting on it, we call that a parking lot attack because you're effectively sitting in the parking lot and you're using the system when you're not supposed to be. And that can easily happen if we're not doing site surveys and thinking about stuff like that. Shared key authentication flaws. If we have a shared key and we are not authenticating properly, we may actually run into issues. So things like, for instance, broadcasting the SSID is something we often talk about and say, well, we shouldn't do that. People should know what it is and know how to connect. Well, okay, that's right. And, you know, you can do that. You do that at home probably, right, to protect your neighbors from doing something illegal, from taking your wireless signal for free, because we don't want them to do that. So if you don't broadcast the SSID, they won't be able to connect. You may use MAC address filtering, for instance, right? You may say only these MAC addresses are allowed to connect to this wireless access point. Again, another step, another link in the chain to create wireless security. Any or all of these things are going to be helpful, but we have to be aware of these issues. We have to think about the use of certificates. Are we going to use certificates in wireless networks to be able to authenticate? We may. It's up to us. We've talked about in prior episodes the use of certificate authorities, the issuance of digital certificates. Remember, an X509 V3 is the formal standard and version for a certificate. And we've talked about why certificates are important. We could use certificates on the client side, so on the endpoints, on a laptop, a desktop, a mobile handheld device, whatever it is. We can use them on the server side. We can use them to be able to do signing, to be able to authenticate. There's all sorts of things that generically certificates are going to be good for, server side or client side. So want to be thinking about those things with regards to how we secure and what kind of protocols we use, especially with regards to wireless, right? We also want to think about lightweight directory access protocol, LDAP. We've talked about this before. This is another area that we have to consider. Do we allow directory services to be able to be used with or without certificates? Normally, without exception, we use certificates to identify users. We link them to user accounts in the LDAP directory, but those certificates are traditionally self-signed. We may want to issue different certificates, and we've talked about perhaps not using the default self-signed certificates, but rather using additional certificates that we will create directly through the CA, through the certificate authority. So we want to be thinking about these kind of things and what they are. Managing the certificates through the LDAP directory gives us enhanced capabilities and enhanced flexibility and visibility with regards to being able to manage certificates and use them securely. We also want to think about how we get from point A through point B to point C. Routing is obviously what we're talking about here. You know, we talked in one of our prior episodes about MPLS and how we can slap a ship to or send to label on a packet and streamline routing by using MPLS to effectively identify the last point of delivery and then quickly expedite routing packages to get there, right? This is pretty cool technology. We can also use what's known as deterministic routing. Deterministic routing is effectively hard coding a path and saying, I want to be able to go from A to B, then to C, and I only want to travel that path. If I can't go A, B, C, I don't want to deliver the packet, I don't want to transmit. So we can statically hard code in effect what the route is. It's called deterministic routing. Routes that are known, that are protected, that are identified, that are entered, are going to be used. The idea behind it is if we statically control the routes and determine them, it's less likely that a hacker can get in and somehow create some sort of misdirection and move us off that path and effectively then try to hack into our systems. So this is important also. This could be a mechanism for protection that may be valuable. But again, we'd have to plan ahead and think about this and decide how are we going to get from A to B to C? What is that route? Identify it and then actually enter it, not just into one router, but into all of them so everybody knows what that route looks like, both going and coming. Because we have to be able to tell A to be able to send through B to get to C, but C also has to be told how to send back going the other way using a deterministic route, or it may not be able to get there. So we have to think about that as well. What about boundary routers? You know, these are routers that sit out on the gateway area of our networks. In other words, at the edge between a LAN and a WAN, at the edge between the known internally and the unknown, the outside dark, scary world, right? We have to think about that because boundary routers are effectively going to be our first line of defense. You know, logically, they may not be, right? Physically, they may not be in the sense we may have routers there, but we certainly are going to also have firewalls. We may have filtering devices, may have packet accelerators, encryption, decryption hardware. It's a lot of things that may in line sit in front of or next to a router. And so you may not get to the router before you get to some of these devices. Inbound packet filtering, in other words, typically done before you are going to necessarily touch all aspects of the boundary, is all I'm suggesting to you. Some may be in front of others. We have to think about that. But a router is usually going to be one of the very first things you connect to, because on your way into the network, you have to cross the router to then be able to get to the inside. So boundary routers are important. How are we securing those? Are we making sure that the routing tables are protected? Are we making sure that if anybody is able to get in and reconfigure the information in a router, change paths, add static routes, for instance, that we're aware of that? You know, it may not be any harder than using a route add command, by the way. You know, route add and then the path minus S at the end to make it static is not much of a complicated command line to type in. It may be a little bit more than that, depending on the kind of router that you use. But even in the most complex routers, you basically have a very simple command to add a path. And so it's not very complicated, potentially. The trick is we need administrative rights, and we need the administrative configuration and logon to be able to do that. But if we're good at what we do in terms of being a defender, we're going to make sure that that information is secure. If we're lax, that information may be found out, and then an actor may come and be able to effectively take over the boundary router. So we do want to think about that. Are we advertising those routes, making them available easily and making them broadcasting them out so other people can see them? Or are we hiding those routes and not making them available? These are all things we'd want to think about. When we think about non-blind and blind hijacking, another very specific kind of solution, we have to think about different ways that we may be able to manipulate traffic and generically understand what traffic is and how to use it to our advantage. So for instance, in non-blind hijacking, we're effectively going to be inside the subnet as the, you know, effectively as the attacker, right, as the bad actor. We're going to be inside. The non-blind refers to having knowledge of the network. So we're going to be on the inside. This may be a bad actor on the inside of your network. This could be somebody who has perhaps taken over a machine. So they've rooted a machine, put a back door in it. They now have an entry point into your network, and they're operating from that inside vantage point to then observe traffic and understand what traffic may look like. As a result of that, they then may be able to figure out how to send data to other systems inside that subnet, inside that network, because effectively they are seen as being local. They're seen as being trusted. This is a non-blind hijacking attack. A blind hijacking attack, on the other hand, blind implies no knowledge. We're outside of the subnet. We really don't know what's going on inside, but we want to try to figure out a way to sneak traffic in there and communicate and take over systems. So in a blind hijacking solution, more sophisticated, obviously, because it's harder to do from outside, we have to figure out how to effectively guess what the packets look like, and most importantly, what sequence numbers are used with the packets. So we're going to do a little demonstration here for you. We're going to take a look at a picture right now, and we're actually going to take a look at what a data capture looks like in Wireshark. I see the little blue fin at the upper left-hand corner there. So we're going to show you Wireshark. Wireshark is a newer version of a years-old product called Etherreel. It was the original product. It was bought, updated, and rebranded as Wireshark. And so you're looking at Wireshark on a Windows machine. And what we've done is just capture some traffic. And you guys think we sit around with nothing to do when we're not talking to you, right? We're working hard here at IT Pro TV when we're not on talking to you guys. So what we did is we did a little quick capture. And actually, we didn't do it because Mike did it. I'm using the royal we because Mike's the one who actually did all the work here. But what we're looking at is a data capture. And we've examined one packet. So we blew up just any one of the packets that was in there. It didn't really matter which. And we're down on the TCP, Transmission Control Protocol line, down towards the bottom of the middle viewer window, which is the actual frame that we can see the packet information in what is acceptable to us as humans, non-hex, in other words. And then if we look down below at the very, very bottom frame, we're actually seeing it in hex. So we're seeing the hexadecimal information there. But that's not really going to do us much good. We got to look up above. And so what we're looking for in this case to execute a blind hijacking attack is the packet sequence number. And I believe Mike is pointing to it and has it highlighted there for us. And it's a sequence packet number ID 1.
This one was started with 0, and started then I can jump down to the next. You can actually see what Adam was talking about earlier with the SYN and then the SYN ACK. And the ACK, what I did was I went out to Google.
Oh, three-way handshake.
Their webpage.
Awesome.
So you can actually see the three-way handshake that Adam was talking about earlier. And then the second packet when Adam jumps to a sequence number of 1. Now, these are saying relative sequence numbers.
Okay, so we have our sequence number. We went from 0, we went to 1. one. And so the idea is that, you know, every packet is going to be given an identifier, a sequence number. I'm one of seven. I'm one of five, right? It's kind of like the Borg, right? You know, one of seven. So the idea is that that sequence number is critical. It is effectively going to tell us what part of the puzzle that data packet belongs to in terms of stitching back together our information. If you imagine, jigsaw puzzle, right? And you imagine all these pieces that together form a picture, but they're scattered, broken up, and although they're numbered, they're not necessarily going to be coming in the right order, and they have to be put back together the right way to effectively create the overall picture. The sequence number is that number you would see on the back of the piece of the puzzle where you turn over and say, oh, it's number five. I have to hook that up with 1 through 4, and then I got to put 6 after it. And that's what the sequence number does. The blind hijacking attack takes advantage of this. We'll send several packets into the network from outside, and we will try to then get back information to help us figure out what the sequence numbers are. We'll then try to sample the sequence numbers in effect. By doing that, we're then going to start crafting attack packets that jump in and take advantage of that sequencing. And because of that, if we get it right, and again, these are hard attacks to propagate, this is sophisticated stuff. You got to use automated technology, and you got to be quick because thousands of packets are transiting right every second. So if we could get it right, what happens is we now substitute our packets in the sequence for the packets that should have been there. We obviously attack and take offline the machine that was sending these packets, and we substitute ourselves for that, and we make the attack packets look like it came from that machine with the right sequencing. We effectively pick up the conversation right where we left off. And as a result of that, right, what ultimately happens is that we effectively are seen as if that's really us, or at least to the receiving system. It seems like we're still having the same conversation, but in effect, we've taken it over, and we're now sending you crafted packets specific to our needs and what we want to accomplish, typically to get some sort of advantage on the machine and take it over. So this is what's called a blind hijacking attack. We may also have man-in-the-middle attacks. Man-in-the-middle attack is another kind of attack that occurs. This is where effectively we try to insert ourselves between the sender and the receiver. We may just surreptitiously, quietly listen and observe, but ultimately we may go active, try to knock the sender offline, and then effectively take over their identity. So a man-in-the-middle attack then becomes a spoof or masquerade attack because now we've gone active, we're trying to pretend to be somebody that we're not. But if all we're doing is surreptitiously, quietly listening, recording information for future use, then it's a man-in-the-middle attack because we're not really doing anything. We're just effectively gathering all the communications and monitoring them as they go back and forth. Very insidious, right? Very, very dark and scary stuff. To combat all these kind of things, we want to think about establishing what's known as a security perimeter. We've talked about this with the outer edge, the boundary, right? The idea is that we may have more than one boundary. We may have, we're going to take a look at something called a DMZ here in just a second, but we may actually have the ability to be able to go in and create a DMZ. And you've probably heard us talk about DMZs before, the demilitarized zone, the thought process behind it being that we create an external, untrusted area of the network. As I do this and my arm goes away, we do an internal untrusted network like that. We do an internal trusted, external untrusted, and we have a place in the middle, which is labeled the DMZ on this beautiful diagram we have here. And that DMZ is going to be semi-trusted, semi-untrusted. So the internet cloud on the right of the diagram is going to be the external untrusted network. The first brick-like structure there is a firewall. We're then going to have an internal network that is partially trusted, partially untrusted, the DMZ. We're then going to have another firewall, and we're then going to have an internal intranet. I like how you use the old school style as opposed to the private cloud, updated version that we buy into for marketing purposes, right?
I haven't updated my terminology.
Oh, yeah, we haven't updated the terminology yet. Mike's a little behind the times, unfortunately. So we have the internal intranet, and the idea is that the DMZ is going to offer us the capability to host things, and I'm guessing, Mike, those may be web servers, for instance, right? They may be boundary security devices. They may be
Front-end mail server.
So, yeah, like a client access server, a CAS or something like that. So whatever they may be, they're going to be systems that we want to make available, but we don't totally want to expose beyond the external firewall, so they have no protection. And so this is a security perimeter. This is one example of one. I think we have another picture, if I'm not mistaken, also, that shows a slightly different view of the same thought process. It's a single firewall. Based DMZ. We can create a firewall, or rather a DMZ physically by having two firewalls and putting stuff between them, or we could create it off one firewall logically by having multiple network access points, network cards or interfaces that effectively connect to different networks and create a sub area, the DMZ, off to one side, but we use a single device to do so. Neither of these is good or bad. Neither of these is right or wrong. It's just a matter of how you choose to architect it. But do understand that the one disadvantage with this particular model is that we have what's known as a single point of failure. If that firewall were to, for any reason, be compromised or for some reason to fail, then in effect, the best case in that scenario would be that all traffic stops flowing because then we can't get anywhere. That's going to be bad, but it's going to be good from a security perspective. The worst case would be that it fails open instead of failing secure. And if it fails open and all the traffic is simply exposed and the networks are exposed, we may now actually have a problem. So again, we have to think about the architecture and the logic of how we set this up, right? This is all obviously going to be very important. So security perimeters are going to be important, and network partitioning is also very important. We may see internal network areas within the LAN overall being carved out for extra security and extra focus, extra capabilities about this, right? We just showed you one way to create a DMZ with a single firewall, but we would call that a dual-homed or multi-homed device. Multiple network connections on there that we can use, and we can use that thought process to be able to create secure internal areas as well. So we want to be thinking about network partitioning and security perimeters, both external to the network on the boundary, but also potentially internally as we step back, because we may have a need to be able to secure internal areas and make sure that we are doing so in a proper way. So I just want to make sure you're aware of those things. And the last thing I want to throw out there for you is something called a bastion host, right? It's fun to say also, by the way, bastion host. Sounds impressive and
it
dark
really
and
does.
Doomy.
It sounds medieval.
Have a bastion host, right? Luke, I'm your father, right? By the way, hey, you know, isn't that, that's like a big thing, right?
Yeah,
Star Wars?
Coming up.
Luke, I'm your father. That's coming up. So Star Wars. So the bastion host is going to be a machine that is going to effectively be what we call fortified. It's a hardened machine. When we use the term bastion host, what we mean is a machine that has all services that are no longer necessary, no longer needed, stripped out. All the applications we don't need are stripped away. We should just be running the minimal things necessary to make that system work. And if we do that, we're hardening the host, and we formally refer to that as a bastion host. So just want to make sure you're aware of that terminology as well.
Very good, Adam. A lot of great information there. You know, we took a look at wireless networks, some of the encryption that we would use on wireless, some of the different IEEE standards that we've got to be familiar with, as well as started getting into, you know, laying out your network and creating DMZs or screen subnets or perimeters, both with outside of our network to keep the, as you say, the bad actors from getting in, but then possibly internally as well for more restricted portions of our network that not everybody in the company needs access to. So great information, Adam. Thank you for all of that. Mm-hmm. Remember, if you guys want to sit in one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email at cadam@itprotv. Let me do that one more time. cadam@itpro.tv.
Or you could see me here because I'm standing in front of you right now. Here I am.
There you go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for this one. Signing off, I'm Mike Rodrick.
I am IEEE. Just before we sign off quickly, you guys really know what IEEE is? Do you know what IEEE is? We often talk about it.
Let's
see.
Institute of Electronics and Electrical Engineers.
You got it backwards, but it's right. Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers is actually the formal title. But either way, Mike was right. So bonus points for him. But when we talk about IEEE, we want to make sure you know that it is an actual organization. And you should go out and check it out. That's where all the standards come from.
It makes for a great bedtime reading.
It does. Very, very good stuff. It's better than hitting yourself in the head with a phone book.
There you go.
I'm Adam Gordon, and we'll see you soon.